when you are, Andy.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. I will call to order this online public meeting. It is August 4th, 2021. My name is Andy Gregg, and I'm the chair of the Clark County Historic Preservation Commission. You should be able to see tonight's agenda on your screen. If you can't see the agenda and have joined by telephone only, I will be announcing the agenda items as we move through the meeting topics. Due to COVID-19, regular meetings and public hearings of the Clark County Historic Preservation Commission will be held in a virtual meeting room. This will allow for safe participation by commission members, staff, and any citizen who's interested in attending. Members of the public and applicants have joined as an attendee, which means you can see and hear the event if you join via computer or mobile device, or you can just hear the event if you join by phone. Other event participants cannot see your video and cannot hear your audio unless you are acknowledged by the commission chair or staff and are unmuted. This evening's agenda is planned as follows: roll call and introductions, meeting notes approval, public comment for subjects other than the public hearings on the meeting's agenda, as there will be specific public comment periods as part of the hearing. Tonight we have two public hearings, one Clark County Register nomination and another a certificate of appropriateness. Then there'll be information about committee updates and announcements, old business, new business, and adjournment. We'll start with a roll call of Historic Preservation Commissioners who are present at this meeting. Members, please say, "I'm here," after I call your name. Julie Bone.
I'm here.
Dan, please note that Greg Foos has been officially excused from tonight's proceeding.
Yes.
Bailey Garcia. Jan Bader.
I'm here.
Morgan Frazier.
I'm here.
Paige Alfuth.
I'm here.
And I'm also here. Thanks, everybody. And we'll not mark Bailey until we know whether she's going to be able to appear or not.
I'm here, team.
You are? Okay. Well, welcome. Very good. Let me write that down in my notes. All right, everyone, we'll move on now to the approval of notes from the July 7th meeting. Does anyone have any comments on the draft July 7 meeting notes?
I do. I think there was an error when the trust attorney made the talked about the violation of the Appearance of Fairness Act. I believe the three commission members they mentioned were Andy, Mr. Foos, and Julie Bone. And in the meeting minutes, it reflects that it was Ms. Garcia, but she did not attend either of the two, the June 2nd or the June 14th meetings where this all was supposed to have occurred. So I think there was an error.
Thank you, Jan.
Yes, thank you.
Any further comments? I'd accept a motion for approval of the July 7 meeting minutes.
With the correction of that section of the minutes that I just mentioned.
Jan has made a motion. Is there a second?
I second it.
I second the motion.
And who was that, Morgan?
Yes.
Or Paige? I couldn't tell.
Morgan. We both
okay, thank
it.
You very much. All right. All in favor of accepting the July 7 meeting notes as amended, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you, everyone. Moving on to public comment. We will now take public comment on any items besides tonight's public hearing items. Please keep your remarks brief and to the point. You'll have 3 minutes to speak. Dan will provide instructions on how to make public comments, and for those joining us through their computer or mobile device, and for those joining by telephone only. Thank you, Dan. Dan, do you see anyone who wants to make a public comment?
All right, it appears Dan is having a mic issue. So this is Jenna with the county. So I'm gonna step in and just check for comments. And also I'll do a quick review of how to do so if anyone in the audience would like to make one. So—
Thank you, and I'd like to introduce Jenna Kay of Clark County staff. Welcome, Jenna.
Thank you. It looks like we've got one person in the audience who is on the phone. So if you are on the phone and would like to make a public comment, you need to press *3 on your phone's number panel, and that will raise your hand. And you'll hear a message that says you have raised your hand to ask a question. Please wait to speak until the host calls on you. At that time, we'll see your hand go up and we'll acknowledge you. And at that point, we will unmute you and you'll hear a message that says you have been unmuted. When you are finished your comment, you can press *3 to lower your hand and you'll hear a message that says you have lowered your hand. So please note, public comment is limited to 3 minutes per person in order to accommodate all speakers. So Andy, I do not see any hands raised to make a comment.
All right, thank you, Jenna. At this time, we'll move on to the public hearing. Clark County Register nomination for the Reba House, 6502 Montana Lane in Vancouver. I will now open this online public hearing for Clark County Historic Register nomination of the Reba House. The steps involved in the hearing process are shown on the slide. Do any commission members have any ex parte contacts and conflicts of interest? Seeing none, we'll move on to staff who will give a summary of the staff report and recommendations. Go ahead, Mark.
Andy, are you able to hear me now?
I am.
Okay, excellent. Sorry for the interruption and apologize for that mic trouble there, but here's some back on. I will transfer the screen sharing over to Mark.
Great, thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Chair Greg. For those of you who may recall, this came before us in May of this year, the Reba House. Let's see, I'm trying to multitask here and share my video same time and again. Okay. Great. You should have as part of your packet a staff report here on the Reba House. It's at 6502 Montana Lane. As I said, this came before the commission on May 5th of this year. The HBC did not recommend approval at that time based on the nomination they reviewed. The last nomination listed the house as mid-century. That has been revised to postmodern, and the updated nomination also includes much more information on the original owner and assumed architect builder, Eminence Reba. Let me take you back to the slideshow here. Site is located north of Mill Plain, just west of Andreessen. near Burnt Bridge Creek. Here are some photos. It's quite a striking structure. At the May 5th hearing, the commission, if you recall, did encourage the owner to update the nomination and come back, and they did in really short order. Apologies to the commission and the owner. We were just a little jammed up with some of the things over the summer, so I wasn't able to get it back until now. But really an interesting feature. The review criteria for nomination on the Clark County Heritage Register is that the building is at least 50 years old or lesser age and has exceptional importance, has integrity of location, design, setting, materials, workmanship, feeling, and association, is significantly associated with the history, architecture, archaeology, engineering, or cultural heritage of the community, and meets at least one of the criteria listed in 1739-070, the Vancouver Municipal Code. And the nomination identified the following two items as applicable, is that it embodies the distinctive architectural characteristics of a type, period, style, or method of design or construction, or represents a significant and distinguishable entity whose components may lack individual distinction. So that's the postmodern style. And then that is it is associated with the lives of persons significant in national, state, or local history. And again, that updated nomination included much more information about Imnence Weba. So staff is recommending approval of the updated nomination. I said as conditioned, I think that's a leftover from my previous staff report. I don't have any conditions on this new recommendation based on the application materials and staff report dated August 4, 2020. So Chair and Commission, that concludes my remarks. And as I said, we have the owner on. In the past, he has not been interested in testifying. He wanted, in my understanding, he wanted the nomination to speak by for itself.
Thank you, Mark. Do commissioners have any questions for Mark?
Mark, so this is there's new build as part of this, right? So the entire house is not from the era that it was originally built. There's an addition, right?
Correct, Commissioner Bader. Yeah, I think I looked at this last time. Part of it was in the 80s or 90s. There was an addition.
Well, I thought it was much more recent than that.
There was a deck that was original, and you'll see like the smaller structure mimics the same roofline as the main house. And then there, right there on the left-hand side. And then there was an addition. They removed the deck, but the addition was built inside that structure. So it kept with the same integrity of the house and kept with the bones.
Okay, that answered my question.
Any other questions for staff? Seeing none, Mr. Nishimura, would you like to comment? Does the commission have any questions for the applicant?
Andy, I think I do.
Okay.
So I feel like the inquiry last time was how exactly this falls into, I mean, obviously it's postmodern, but what the significance was as far as its architecture in the historic register. So I just want to know what changed since the last time we reviewed this one.
Commissioner, was that to staff?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. The classification on the original nomination was mid-century modern. And what we heard at that May hearing was that perhaps it wasn't mid-century modern and was more of a postmodern structure. So the major differences that I found in my review was the classification of the structure as postmodern as opposed to mid-century, and then much more detail on Imnens Reba, the original owner of the site.
Thank you, sir.
We'll now open the public comment period related specifically to the Reba House nomination. Please note that if you wish to retain the ability to be a party of record on this matter, or to challenge or defend any decision made on this matter, please state, spell your name, and provide your mailing address or email address for the record. Staff will now provide instructions on how to make a public comment for those joining us through their computer or mobile device, and for those joining by telephone. Dan?
Yes, so for any attendees using your computer or WebEx application, if you would like to speak, please utilize the raised hand icon. You can do this by clicking the participant button or icon. The location depends on the device you're using. Staff will acknowledge attendees who have used the raised hand button by selecting that icon. When you're acknowledged, you will be unmuted. For attendees attending in by telephone with audio only, you can press *3 on your phone's number panel to raise your hand. You will hear a message on your end that says, you have raised your hand to ask a question. Please wait to speak until the host calls on you. When you're acknowledged, you will be unmuted, and you will hear a message that says you have been unmuted, after which commission will be able to hear you speak. When you finish your comment, press *3 to lower your hand. You will hear a message on your receiver that says you have lowered your hand. Please note the public comment is limited to 3 minutes per person in order to accommodate all speakers. All right, looks like we have no raised hands.
Okay, thank you, Dan. Seeing that there is no testimony or questions for the applicant and the public hearing is now closed. The commission will now deliberate. The commission must make findings that either agree or disagree with the staff's finding on each criteria, or make specific comments on any finding. I'll open the discussion for anyone who wants to participate.
I'll go first. This is Paige.
Okay.
Hi, yeah, so I agree with the review criteria that this meets. The application was put together really nicely, the content, and I think this fits the postmodern style in a unique way, you know, not maybe traditionally to postmodern, like, I guess, for example, the Portland building in Portland, that's very, very postmodern, but this is a little interesting, different take. It has the roof lines that are really unique. And I think it is very significant in the engineering skills on how it was built, specifically with the floor joists. They're, you know, true timbers. There's over 50-foot ridge span, ridge beam span. And it just has cool orientation, specifically to the application pointed out, the true to the north-south, unlike other buildings in the neighborhood that are parallel to the street. And it opens up to Mount St. Helens and beyond, a very expansive view. So the site in itself is pretty cool. It's over 50 years old. It embodies 70s. And it is associated with a significant person in history. Mr. Reba seemed to be a really smart man and brought innovation to this world, I guess. I thought that the roof replacement and the stainless steel frames added helped, you know, bring longevity to the structure, so it'll be around longer. And I thought it looked really nice and looked really a great like for like example kind of what it originally was intended to be. So yeah, I just support this nomination, and it just left me wanting to know more and dive more into history of this architect. I would be interested, it said that they tried to find the plans, the original plans for the building, and wasn't successful. So that's a little disappointing, because as Mr. Reba was the presumed architect, I would really like to find out, you know, if he was the actual engineer of the project, as well as the architect. So, but I'm for this nomination.
Thank you very much, Paige. Any other comments from commissioner members?
This is Julie. I'll go.
This is Morgan. I was.
Oh, Andy, your call.
Oh, please, Morgan, go ahead.
I was just going to say I was really excited to see this nomination. I don't think that we have very many representations of this type of unique architectural style, and it's just hitting the 50-year mark. So we are probably going to see more postmodern architecture come up, and it's really exciting to see this before the commission, and I support the nomination. I read the original nomination and the upgraded nomination, and I think the applicant went above and beyond to tell us all about Dr. Reba and his contributions to the scientific community. And you can probably just imagine him thinking about building this crazy house and designing it, and it's pretty fascinating. And I will say to Paige, right now the Clark County, whatever they are, the tax people and whoever, they're redoing all of everything. They're digitizing everything. They have everything lost. Everything is lost. If you go there and you try to find something, they can't find it for you. It's super frustrating. But I think that that could bubble up in the future, something that might come to light if they can hurry up the organization.
I hope so. That'd be nice.
Julie, please go ahead.
Thanks, Andy. Yeah, I just wanted to thank Mr. Nishimura for being patient and amplifying the application that he had submitted previously. We all, I think, were in agreement at that time that this would be an excellent possibility to be on the register. So thank you very much for going back and doing that additional research that we asked for. I don't need to recap what everyone has already said, but I really do think this is quite an architectural gem for our community, and appreciate the level of effort you put into adding more detail about the architecture, how it's significant to that time period, and also all of the research you put in about the initial owner, potential architect, potential engineer. That was very interesting, and it was much more robust than the original. I think the original was 8 pages or so, and this last one was 64. So I felt like you really did do a lot of legwork for this to be nominated. And I just want to thank you, and I also support this nomination.
Thank you, everyone. Any further comments? At this time, I'd like to accept a motion, including the finding. Please say your name when making a motion and second, so staff can capture it for the record.
I, Paige Elfith, make a motion to. Do I just say to call this nomination to vote?
Yeah, so should you like to move to approve them to approve the application?
Oh, I, Paige Elfith, make a motion to move to approve the application.
Thank you. Is there a second?
I'll second. This is Julie.
Okay, second from Julie Bone. It's been moved and seconded that the Reba House be included in the Clark County Historic Register. Dan, would you please take the roll to approve this motion?
Yes. We'll start with Julie.
Yes.
Felia Garcia.
Aye.
Jan Bader?
Aye.
Morgan Frazier? Morgan?
Aye.
There we go.
Aye, Morgan.
There we go. We got you, Morgan. Thank you. Paige Elfuth?
Aye.
And Andy Gregg?
Aye.
All right. And Greg is has an excused absence today, so that is 6-0. Motion passes.
The motion passes. Thank you, everyone. Congratulations, Mr. Nishimura. At this time, we'll move on to the public hearing, a certificate of appropriateness in the application for the improvement of the John Stanger House, 9215 Southeast Evergreen Highway in Vancouver. I will now open this public hearing for the certificate of appropriateness application for the improvements at the John Stanger House for a proposed weather station with fenced enclosure. The steps involved in the hearing process are shown on a slide. Do commission members have any ex parte contacts or conflicts of interest? Seeing none, staff will now give a summary of the staff report and recommendations. Go ahead, Mark. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair Greg. I just want to make a clarification. I think you may have been reading off of a past script there about the weather station. So just to be clear, no weather station included as part of the improvements here on this site.
Was that from the Clark County Farm Historic Farm?
Could have been. Could have been.
I thought it might be, but you never know.
It's okay. It's okay. Thanks, Chair Greg. Yes, the Stanger House is located on, it's already on the Clark County Heritage Register and the National Register of Historic Places. So the commission's responsibility is to review any changes to proposed properties on the local register. Those are the certificate of appropriateness. The applicant has come forward to request approval for repairs and restoration. Specifically, items to be repaired and replaced include siding and exterior trim, updates, improvements, repairs, excuse me, to the south and north porches, windows, exterior doors, kitchen floors, gutters, interior shiplap, house skirting, and chimney and fireplace. So I'll have some pictures here in a moment, but you'll be able to see this is believed to be one of the oldest structures in the city, and it's starting to show its age. So we're happy that some folks have come forward to help it out. The criteria for improvements are based on the Secretary of the Interior standards for rehabilitation, and I have those listed in my staff report here. We can go through those kind of as needed. Pull up my PowerPoint here. As Chair Greg indicated, the site is located south of, south of Evergreen Highway. Here are some photos that were included in the applicant materials, south and north porches, now the south facade. And here's the design review criteria: that every reasonable effort shall be made to provide a compatible use for a property. No change of use is proposed. The distinguishing original qualities or character of a building structure or site and its environment shall not be destroyed. The removal or alteration of any historic material or distinctive architectural features should be avoided when possible. All building structures and sites shall be recognized as products of their own time alterations that have no historical basis and would seek to create an earlier appearance, they'll be discouraged. Review criteria continued here. Changes which may have taken place in the course of time are evidence of the history and development of a building structure or site and its environment. These changes may have acquired significance in their own right, and this significance shall be recognized and respected. Distinctive stylistic features or examples of skilled craftsmanship which characterize a building structure or site shall be treated with sensitivity. Deteriorated architectural features shall be repaired rather than replaced whenever possible. The surface cleaning of structures shall be undertaken with the gentlest means possible. Sandblasting and other cleaning methods that will damage the historic building materials shall not be undertaken. Every reasonable effort shall be made to protect and preserve archaeological resources affected by or adjacent to any project. And I do just want to take a moment because we did get a call from a concerned person. There was a story in the Columbian, I think recently, about some work done around the old outhouse here, and the person was just wanted to make sure that archaeological care was taken in that endeavor. So I do have a condition of approval in the staff report. If any land disturbing measures are taken, that we do follow the appropriate protocols for archaeological finding. Because as part of what's proposed here, it doesn't sound like there's going to be much, but just want to make that a point. Contemporary design for alterations and additions to existing properties shall not be discouraged when such alterations and additions do not destroy significant historical, architectural, cultural material. No additions are proposed, and whenever possible, new additions or alterations to structures shall be done in such a manner that if such additions or alterations are to be removed in the future, the essential form and integrity of the structure would be unimpaired. I'll go back to my photos here. Staff is recommending, sorry about that, team. I was putting this together hastily. Staff is recommending approval of the certificate of appropriateness, as this is already on the local register, based on the materials, staff report, and conditions of approval dated August 4, 2021. That I will entertain any questions from the commission.
Do commissioners have any questions for Mark?
Yeah, I was wondering if you were going to receive any samples of replacement for the material that's going to be, if it has to be replaced, if certain materials have to be replaced. Like asking for samples of material that they will be using.
We, like a materials board, commissioner,
yeah, I guess essentially just to make sure it's like for like, I guess.
Mm-hmm. We'd like to see that if possible. So that's certainly something that the commission can make as a condition of approval, is that prior to building permit issuance or the certificate of appropriateness, that the HPC would like to see samples of materials to be replaced where they cannot be repaired.
Any further questions for staff?
So I have a question. Hey, Mark, this is Julie. It did seem that there were some mention of potential alterations. For example, that second floor used to be a door, which had an external staircase, which of course is no longer attached to the building. And they were recommending that they would actually do some new siding and create a window there potentially. And to me, that is quite a big alteration to the structure. Do you have any thoughts or comments about why that wasn't considered one in the report?
I guess I would say that it's kind of on the line, but I hear what you're saying. That could be a more significant alteration for sure.
Okay. And I have questions for that, too.
Oh, I had that thought as well. Yeah.
Is the applicant...
Would the applicant like...
Well, I was going to ask, is the applicant going to make a presentation on this one? Because I think we probably have some questions for them.
We have them available for questions.
So no formal presentation. You're the presentation, but they're available to answer questions.
That's my understanding, yes.
Well, in the absence of applicant providing additional testimony, we do have the capacity for commissioners to ask questions of the applicant at this time.
Andy, I think a lot of us have questions. So how do you want to organize us to go through them?
We have, is Mike Hale available, the applicant?
I am.
Great. I'll tell you what, I'll just go through our roll call list, and if folks have questions, then they can pose them. So Julie's number one on the roll call, so please go ahead.
Okay, thanks Andy. Hi Michael, I want to first thank you for your application and appreciate the materials that you put together for us. So it's awesome that you recognize, you know, and that this is a building that people care about and want to do renovations to improve its integrity. But I do have a couple of just clarifying questions. And so bear with me because there's a variety of notes that I have. One of the things I just simply wanted to ask was in terms of painting the exterior the same color and same trim, there's that shadow. There's a proper term, and my colleague Paige may be able to help me out with the term, but there's a shadow of what I'm going to call of the staircase on the exterior, which I find a very interesting historical element to the building. And so I just was curious if there's a way when you paint, is it possible or would there be an interest in maintaining that to kind of demonstrate the history that this building has gone through and that there was a staircase that did go up to that second floor and that was where it was located. And somehow in that painting process still maintain that shadow. And I don't know if there had been any thought or discussion about that or if there wasn't really a desire to keep that. That was just one question.
The issues we had is we don't know when that stairwell was put in and it's been removed for over 20 years.
So, oh, I see.
So the problem and the other thing too is I can't find the door.
Right.
So that's why we decided to try to just eliminate that stairwell. However, as far as painting goes, anything's possible. We could tape that off or something and paint around it. The issue we've had is replacement of siding and also substructure. We've had a lot of dry rot. We're making our own siding for any replacement siding we need from what we haven't found on site. So that's another issue we've had with that. So painting, yeah, I think it could be done.
And you brought up a good point. Without knowing when that staircase was there, it may not be relevant to the renovation, but I didn't know if you had that information. So that's helpful to know. That's kind of unknown.
Yeah, in reality, restoration to me would be removing that siding and getting back to the original vertical planks that are on that house. However, we don't have the funds to do it.
Mm-hmm. So my next,
do you have an idea when it was sided with this current siding?
It does have some square nails in it, but there's also some round headed nails, probably around the turn of the century, I would say, for some of it, and then some of it was added later.
Okay. So I had a question about the second item regarding the kitchen porch ceilings. I was curious if you have a picture. It's difficult to kind of really visualize what's transpiring there in terms of what's being removed. And I was also curious why salvage materials from the south porch and replace them to the north to then only replace all of the south. I was just curious what the logic there was instead of maintaining the south, repairing what's repaired, and then doing the same on the north side or the north porch.
Two reasons. One was the substructure. There was a lot of dry rot in it, so we had to go in and do repairs on that. So we had to take all of the ceiling panels down to do that, or the ceiling tongue and groove boards. The other thing is, it was probably 70% of that roof was not salvageable. So we used the 30% to repair holes and repair the north porch. And then we purchased all new tongue and groove siding, or tongue and groove 1x4 for the south porch here. So.
Oh, so it's already finished. I mean, it's already been done.
Yeah, we started this process with the application in February. So we got into the summer season and we just had to get started. So.
How large, so the, going on to the French doors and upstairs outside door, how large is that door opening on that second floor? Do you know?
It's approximately about 6 foot. Well, actually, the second floor door is 32 inches wide. So the downstairs is closer to 6 foot. So
it's the upstairs one that I was curious about. I think that it just seems to me that instead of replacing the door with a smaller window, with a, you know, kind of cramming it into a smaller space, since you have that opening, to actually replace that with a window that matches that footprint of the door, rather than removing that footprint of the door.
And we can, however, it would not be done within the next 2 years due to the cost of a window that size.
Okay. And then, do you know when the French doors were added to the house? Are there any photos of an earlier date to understand how they functioned? You know, in the report, it says that there may have been a small porch or a planter.
Correct.
I'm just curious, when were they always French doors? Was this something changed? Is there any history that we know of to kind of help us understand where they fit?
My understanding, what I have seen is that was all vertical plank siding there because it was cut off below and up above those doors. So it's not part of the original house. However, when French doors became vogue and were put in, that's another question I can't answer for sure. So we just don't know.
Okay. Then on item 4 for the windows, it mentions that most window, it was a little confusing. It says that most windows do not need repairs on the first floor, and there's some detail, but then it says some glass needs to be replaced. Is the glass broken? I'm not sure what.
Yeah, the bathroom window has they installed plexiglass for the already. Window. There is no 1/1. It's just a piece of plexiglass stuck in there. So we'd like to replace that with a full size window for that opening.
Okay, that's.
And the others are small windows, and there's just holes in the glass or broken panes, and a lot of that is just replacing the broken panes of glass.
Okay, I think I understand.
And another point is, on the second floor, a lot of the glass is broken out. There's an 2 8/8 windows, but those were not floated glass that were there. So those were installed at a later date. So.
So is the nomination based on its 1820s, 1830s date, or was the nomination for being on the historic register? I did read through it, but I don't recall it necessarily needing to be the original. It's just part of that historic integrity from whether it be the 18th or the 19th century.
I think two things, and Mark can back me up on this if I'm wrong, is number one, it's on its original site. Original property. And number two, John Stanger worked at the Fort Vancouver site as a millwright. So those are the two things I think that it was nominated on. So
in terms of replacement, is there a period of time that this house is meant to be, you know, in terms of replacement and restoration and or renovation, whichever term you're going to choose to use. Is there a certain time period? Because it sounds like different things are saying, well, I'm not sure if that's the original. So, you know, I guess I'm just trying to get at the heart of the preservation, if that makes sense. Well, so
My goal is to make this house last for 10 to 15 more years, and it's going to have to be redone again. There's no question in my mind that this is going to be ongoing work to do this. A lot of the siding is in really poor shape. It'll probably last, with even with a good paint job, probably 10 to 15 years. So something will have to be done in the future. This is just a temporary fix that I'm going through, trying to repair the dry rot.
Right.
I'm trying to repair what we can.
So. Yeah, which is greatly appreciated. I can see that you know, it is obviously a lot of work. I have just two or three other questions, clarifying questions. So for the item number 5, you do mention that, I wanted to understand the historic context of those doors you plan to replace. And if you have any samples, or if there's any, what so far has transpired to determine what to replace them with? Is that something we could see an example of in the future if we were to postpone this nomination to get more details like this? Can you tell us a little bit about that selection?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking for. The doors have been cut down from some other doors. They're not full original doors.
Mm-hmm. So you say here, the kitchen doors and frame require replacement due to vandalism and other damages. So understandably, correct, they need to be replaced. So what are you basing your decisions on to replace those doors?
Framing the doors themselves, there's multiple locks. There's one door was kicked in, so even the door frame was broken. Hinge areas are rotted out. So
again, do you have, like, what kind of door are you?
I have no vision for doors yet, because okay, we haven't got that far. We don't have the money to do it.
Okay. And then I guess the other last question I really had was, again, regarding samples or examples, even just images of the type of the gutter choices that were being proposed. Clearly, it's a necessary.
The V-shaped gutter would be the same as Fort Nisqually, which is the same time period as the original structure of the Stanger House. Trough wood gutters were used around the turn of the century. Wood trough gutters were used around the turn of the century here in Vancouver.
And so no pictures or samples or examples that you can demonstrate to us, but just
verbally. To get a sample, 1 foot is $10 a foot. So I'm not going to go buy a sample for 10 bucks, but I can take a picture of it.
Yeah. And just as an example, you know, previous certificates of appreciation applicants have provided us with different styles or samples just to demonstrate how it will look on the historic structure. So that's why.
This is just to eliminate water damage to the existing structure. Because we've had some issues with no gutters, so.
Yeah. And no doubt they're needed, just interested in seeing what they would look like. So that's the extent of my clarifying questions. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Julie. Bailey, did you have any questions for the applicant?
I have no questions at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Jan, do you have additional questions?
I do have a few. So Mike, it sounds like some of the scope of work you're proposing has already been completed. And so the certificate of appropriateness for those projects is sort of after the fact of what the scope that you're proposing. I mean, just how much of it's been completed already?
The only thing we've done is the north and south kitchen porches. We've also found out that we could the existing floors in the kitchen were good. So we tore up the linoleum. They had a 1/4-inch plywood over the top of it. Repaired it all, refinished it, and stained and sealed it. So a lot of the stuff we're doing is cosmetic on the inside of the house. And what we're doing on is trying to get to the dry rot, be honest with you, Jan, on the outside. So replace siding that has been destroyed. We've done that, and the two ceilings on the exterior porches are basically what's been done.
Okay. So timing of this, it sounds like it's based on funds as they become available.
Correct.
So essentially this could be a multi-year project and you will, you know, triage things based on what's most pressing and then move forward as you have funding available.
Correct. I probably won't be around to see the end of this project, so.
This might be for you or for John, but who the actual owner of the property is a nonprofit organization. Is that correct?
Yes, I'll let John go through that.
Because I know it's John signed the application, but I'm pretty sure he didn't own it.
Well, John's the chairman of the board for the Jane Weber Arboretum, Evergreen Arboretum. So he could.
So it's a foundation or
correct
something.
Yeah.
Jan, the organization, the Jane Weber Evergreen Arboretum, is a 501c3 organization. It received the property from the Clark College Foundation a couple of years ago, and we're in the process of, you know, getting better organized and figuring out how to raise funds for this. Matter of fact, just recently we were told that we're getting a small grant from a foundation. We just have to raise a little money to match it, and that'll help pay for all the materials. So far, all the labor has been volunteer by Mike and his crew. Crew of people who are very meticulous about how they do the work to try and retain the historic appearance of the house. But the organization, the board, is committed to trying to restore this house as much as we possibly can. It's going to require a lot of fundraising and trying to get the attention of people who are generous. To make this house look like what it can be. Our intent is to keep the historic look, not to to make it something from the 50s or 60s, at least not the 1950s and 60s, more from the 1850s and 60s. And it's going to take a lot of craftsmanship to make that work. And we've been fortunate in finding some people who are craftsmen.
Okay. Julie asked a lot of the questions that I was going to ask, so I will. I'll just hold my comments for the rest of my comments for the deliberation period. Okay, Andy.
Okay, Morgan. Any comments?
Well, Julie asked a lot of really great questions, and they were answered, but I'm a little bit concerned with, it sounds like this is a very long plan for preservation and restoration of this structure. I feel that it would be in the best interest of the structure and probably the nonprofit if they came up with a better plan for preservation and restoration that would outlive some of the people that might not make it to the end. And in doing that, when having a plan, you kind of address some of the materials and some of the questions that were asked by the commissioners. And without a plan, it's just a matter of trust. And then I'm a little bit offset that, you know, you kind of already started the work, though it is COVID, and I understand, and, you know, commissions get stalled. But there is a process, and that was sort of jumped over because of timing and not really because of procedure. So that's a little bit concerning to me personally. Also, the Stanger House does sit on an pre-contact archaeological site that's protected under state law. So I am concerned also about any ground disturbance. I know that there was a survey done and a site found just outside the house. I just think that with something as significant as the Stanger House, having an actual historic preservation kind of plan for the next 10 years or whatever this vision is that the organization sees would benefit the organization, the community, the fundraising. It's really easy to fundraise when people know what they're fundraising for. And I would have a hard time just throwing money at somebody who says they're going to fix up a building that doesn't have a plan in place. That said, I know that you're probably strapped for cash, but this is something you can also reach out to. There are volunteers in the community who would love to assist in doing these kinds of things. That's just something I would like to suggest to the applicant that they consider going forward, is really creating a master plan or a preservation plan for the structure. And perhaps even, I think there was an outhouse at one time. I do see that in the National Registration Nomination Form that I received, not in my packet, but on my own. So that's pretty much what I have to say. Julie had some really good points about the buildings, as did Paige. I do like the ideas of the gutters. I've seen those done, and I've actually made those gutters before. Don't buy gutters when I don't buy cedar when I make those gutters. I actually just follow logs, but I think that's really appropriate when it comes to dispersing the water and keeping that look, because of course there's no metal in 1850 to put on your gutter. Thank you.
Thanks, Morgan. Paige, any further comments?
Thank you for your application, Mike. I think this could be a really cool thing. It's so old. I do just want to know, is this I know right now it's closed to the public. Is this planned to be open so the public can, you know, walk through at that end? Is that like the end goal where there'll be people able to come visit?
John, you want to handle that one?
Okay, actually, it is open to the public now.
Okay.
We've been, we call them guided tours, but they're not real formal. We had a recent function there, the 50th wedding anniversary for Don and Carolyn Bonker, and the house was staged for people to come and see it. And we had, I'd say, more than half of the guests did tour the house to see what was there. It's still safe to go inside. I mean, it's not an unsafe structure. What we're trying to do, of course, is to make sure it doesn't deteriorate anymore. That's there's a concern about the work that we went ahead and had completed. But part of the reason for that was to prevent, you know, additional damage.
Okay. Well, that's great that it's still and you know, it's not dilapidated by any means. That's really great. Have you ever thought of having a fundraiser at the site location so people could see what their money will go to potentially?
Oh, absolutely. The board is actually just getting started on the long range planning process. The idea of creating a plan for the house itself and for the Arboretum as a whole is on our agenda. And how long it's going to take us to do it, nobody is sure, but we're gathering the information that we can to make a plan. And we're hoping that by the end of the year, we'll have something to work with.
Cool. Thank you.
Any further comments from commissioners? Seeing none, we'll now open a public comment period related specifically to the certificate of appropriateness application. Please note that if you wish to retain the ability to be a party of record on this matter or to challenge or defend any of the decisions made on this matter, please state your name, spell your name, provide your mailing address and or email address for the record. Staff will now provide instructions on how to make public comment for those joining us through their computer mobile devices or for those joining by audio only.
For attendees using their computer WebEx application, if you'd like to speak, please use the raise hand icon shown on the screen, and you can do this by clicking the participant button or icon. The location depends on the device you're using at this time. Staff will acknowledge those attendees during the comment period who have their raised hand icon. When you're acknowledged, you will be unmuted. For folks attending via telephone, you need to press *3 to raise your hand. You'll hear a message on your end that says, you have raised your hand to ask a question. Please wait to speak until the host calls on you. When you're acknowledged, you will be unmuted, and you will hear a message on your end that says you've been unmuted. And when you have finished your comment, please press *3 to lower your hand, and you'll hear a message on your end confirming that you have lowered your hand. And we'll note again that public comment is limited to 3 minutes per person to accommodate all speakers. We'll check to see if we have any. Let's see. It looks like, Andy, I'm not seeing any hands raised.
Okay, thank you, Dan. In as much as there's no public comment or questions for staff to or applicant to respond to, this public hearing is now closed. The commission will now deliberate. The commission must make findings that either agree with the staff findings on each criteria or make specific comments on any finding. So we'd open it up for discussion, and please identify yourself when you speak.
This is Jan. So
go ahead, Jan.
It sounds like the you know, they've got quite a long timeline on this, and it is going to move forward as funds are available. So I'm wondering, I don't know how many commissioners have actually been to the Sanger House. And so I'm wondering if we could postpone the decision on the certificate of appropriateness for till the September meeting, and then potentially organize a tour so that Mike and John can show us the house, because I think it would be easier to understand a lot of what's being proposed if we could actually be there and see what's being proposed. So I don't know if that, I mean, I don't know the timeline that Mike's working on this. Sounds like some work's already been done, but I'm wondering if it would be appropriate to just delay the decision for a month till the September meeting so that we can go take a look at it.
Any response? Go ahead. Go ahead, Paige.
Oh, sorry. I was muting and unmuting. I don't know what. I do like that idea that Jan was saying. It would be nice to be able to go on site and see what they're proposing specifically. I think there might be a lot of unanswered questions about how they're progressing with, you know, the updates. So that might be an effective way for us to visually see it.
Any other commission comments?
This is Julie. I would also say, actually, I think that's a really great idea, Jan. I'm curious if the applicant is open to that, and because I echo what Jan said and what Paige said. I think that it's just, it has been something that we, without COVID, I think would normally do. And now that we are actually potentially going back in person in September, this would be a good kind of transition to get that back into our way of doing business.
Because frequently we have done tours of sites when there's a request.
Right. Yeah. So I'm just curious. So anyway, I that's my comment, but I'm curious if the applicant, what their response could be, if that's possible.
I wouldn't have a problem with it.
That would be great. And then you can kind of show, it's so much easier when you're standing there and you're saying, well, this is what we're proposing to do, rather than trying to do it through pictures and verbal description. So that would be great. I'm sure Daniel would be happy to arrange a time for a tour. Or Mark.
So colleagues, are we now contemplating tabling the motion pending a site visit?
I think so. Yeah.
Yes.
How about if we have a motion to that effect, please?
Yeah, I'll move that we table the action on this certificate of appropriateness until we've had a site visit.
So Jan Bader has proposed that we table this action pending a site visit. Is there a second?
I second that. This is Paige.
Thank you, Paige. Any further discussion on this issue? So it's been moved and seconded that this matter be tabled and pending a site visit. So Dan, if you'd please take the roll call on this motion.
Sure. Julie Vaughn.
Aye.
Kelly Garcia.
Aye.
Jan Bader.
Aye.
Morgan Frazier.
Aye.
Paige Elfu.
Aye.
And Andy Gregg.
Aye. So we'll look forward to visiting.
And with that, I'll note for everybody's reference, especially commissioners that haven't gone on a site visit before. So to comply with the State Open Meetings Act, we will have to stagger the site visit so that this is not a public meeting, not a meeting with a quorum of commissioners. So these are logistics that Jackie Camp and I will sort out amongst ourselves with Mike and John, but just noting for the record that that's the way that we'll structure it. So it may be one or two of you at a time. Yeah, happy to arrange that and of course coordinate with Mark as well.
Thank you. And Dan, for the record, we could have as many as three because we need four for a quorum.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. At this time, we'll move on to committee updates and announcements. This piece of business originally arose late on the evening of July 7th, when at the end of a long agenda. And so one of my goals as commission chair is to have vigorous and active committees, because they're of great assistance to our work. And right now, we have the underrepresented Communities Committee, which is led by Bailey Garcia. We have the Vancouver Heritage Code Committee, Overlay Code Committee. We have the SEPA Providence Academy Committee, which may not require any further participation at this time. And then Morgan and I have agreed to be on River Channel Maintenance Committee, and we're waiting to participate in one of those meetings.
And don't we also have a grant review committee?
Yes, we have. And that's what I was going to ask, Dan, is that our colleagues aware of any others? And there's grant review committee. And so at the conclusion of our July meeting, I asked for folks to please consider participating on one or more of the committees. And it looks as if I have volunteered for most of them, but I would be very happy to give my place, except of course on the River Channel Maintenance, because that'll be a new one for me. But anyway, I would just like to encourage colleagues to please consider participating in a committee assignment. Some of our very best work in the past has been accomplished by dint of their dedicated service. And so with that, if you could let Dan know, would that be okay, Dan? For folks to use you as a contact, or you can contact me as well. I'd be happy to do this.
Andy?
Dan, are you aware of, go ahead.
I'm just curious, you mentioned that Philly is the one who chairs the underrepresented communities, but you didn't mention how to or who to reach out to for the others. Has a committee already been established for the grants?
Right, well, according to my informal notes, the underrepresented communities committee led by Philly includes Julie and me.
Right, and, but the other ones, yeah.
And also the The overlay district, I don't know that we have anybody formally on it. And I think if memory serves, Greg had been interested in the Providence Academy SEPA review, but he's not here to speak, and so I can't speak for him. Any other commissioners who are aware of participation on a committee, I'd appreciate them responding at this time. Morgan?
I just am aware of the one committee that I volunteered for.
Right. I just saw the blue box come on, so I thought you wanted to weigh in.
So
Julie, I think that's all the information. Go ahead.
So the Grant Commission hasn't yet been set up. I'm guessing that that's something that's coming up once we have the funding and all that is set established. Once the deadline is
received. That's true. And I remember that you had participated on that one in the past, as had I. And that's a very good committee to be on. That's a really important one.
I'm happy to serve on that one.
Jan. Okay, thanks, Jan.
Do we know when the application and what the, I don't know if Dan has any updates for us on.
I think the applications are already out, right? The deadline is in September.
September.
Okay. So it would happen thereafter. Okay.
Right. I think I remember meeting in either late September, or early October. Last time we did this, which was in 2019. I don't think we did this last year.
We didn't.
I'm sorry, Julie. I was just for the record that the deadline is September 24th. So we do have one more meeting between now and then.
Okay.
All right.
And I'll just plug this committee. I would love to be on this committee again, but I think everyone should have an opportunity because it's such a great experience. So if we fall short of volunteers, I will volunteer, but I will not in the event that others that are new to the commission would like to participate. So I'll just throw that
out there. Me too. And that's also a very good committee for recent additions to the commission to consider, because you get to know what's going on in the community, and it gives you a chance to work with Jackie and Dan and Jenna, and that it pays a lot of dividends in terms of experience, as I would say. I hope Julie would agree with me on that.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and it's also a lot of fun knowing that, you know, what we're doing is making a positive impact on historic preservation, all the community that serve, this is the word. So yeah.
Moving to old business, after we leave the committees that have promise for community outreach and to benefit folks that we serve, we do also have a call for participation on the HPC Rules and Procedures Update Project. And I was going to make a poor pun and said, let bylaws be bylaws, but Dan has asked that we participate in this one. And so, Dan, would you outline the request here, please?
Sure, yeah, I can go over that one briefly. So the rules and procedures update, we've talked about this a bit before, but bringing the formal ask up again today. The current Historic Preservation Commission rules and procedures were adopted in 2008. We've had a few code amendments at the county side as well as with the city of Vancouver between now and then. 2009, 2018, and 2019 at the county and with the city of Vancouver in 2014 and 2020. So with that, we want to update our rules and procedures to make sure that we are congruent with those code changes, as well as making some updates that improve the user friendliness of the rules and procedures, both for commission members as well as for members of the public accessing the rules and procedures. And then, of course, taking some work to put in procedures that reflect changes that we've made during the COVID-19 pandemic and whether or not we want to anticipate something like that in the future. This is a draft schedule of the project. So initially conceived to be kicking off in earnest during this third quarter of the year. Schedule can adjust a little bit as we haven't gotten started yet. So we could shift this a little bit, but given the idea that it'll take approximately, we're estimating about a year and a half to get started with taking an assessment of what we see in the rules and procedures today, set some goals for those changes, and getting started with a new draft. And then, as you see here, like our intent would be the committee would work on that first draft. And then once the committee's happy with that first draft, we would bring that to the larger commission to consider before finalizing. So with that said, as Andy and Julie have said, the ask is that you all make a motion to create the Rules and Procedures Update Committee today, and then we would need some volunteers to volunteer this one.
Just a couple observations, Dan. A lot of public bodies have policy review as a part of the regular meeting. It's a pretty broad topic. And would there be any sense in including in the packet portions of the rules and procedures as they are, so that, because everybody should be familiar with these.
Mm-hmm.
And that it puts a great onus on a committee of 2 or 3 people to undergo a policy review such as this. And they become very familiar with the ins and outs of the rules and procedures of the commission. And then everybody else hears about it after they've gone to a great deal of time and trouble. And so I would like to have a learn as we go component, so that we have established a sense of what the rules and procedures are for everyone. Could you put that timeline back up on there, please?
Sure.
Because if we look at this, goal, some of the participants are going to be at the end of their tenure by the time we get to an implementation stage. And so to be at the end of one's tenure or at the end of one's first term, and as we saw in the past, not everybody wants to reapply for a second term, that I would like to know about the rules and procedures before I retire. And I was wondering if there is any sense into having the scope of this work. You know, we could establish a committee who could steer it, but this would be critical for, since we have 3 new members on the commission, it would be critical for folks to understand and not be surprised when we get to, you know, the committee draft or the commission draft, which is going to be a year or more down the road. That's what I'm thinking about.
So I want to ask a question. So, I mean, obviously code is fairly complex. And so are you envisioning that staff would take the current rules and procedures and like redline them to meet the changes in the code, and then the commissioners would talk about that? Because having commissioners having to go through pages and pages and pages of code and try to do that themselves, even in a small committee, is going to be a huge task. So I'm envisioning that you and Jackie and maybe Mark are going to take the first stab at this, and then the committee will have a red line that we can walk through, or they can walk through, rather than having committee members try to do this. Not to put you on the spot, Dan.
No, that's all right, Jan. I appreciate that. I agree with you that that's a fairly conventional approach, that we would, that would be the first pass, would be to go through and make sure that any changes to make it compliant with the updated code would be the first step. And changes that are more to the user friendliness or organization of the document itself, that's not, you know, pertinent to that code compliance, that's stuff that we can discuss more after that step.
And also, if we had it a recurring agenda item, it would also be evidence to the people who we serve that we are learning as we go, and that there's a continuing education component to the work of the commission. And because I think a lot of things operate in mystery, just because it's done by a committee, and then it comes before. And I've been a party to many useful committees that create a great draft that's approved, and it's only referred to occasionally. So maybe this could be a recurring theme.
So you're thinking, and then we, sections at a time.
Go ahead.
So like
yeah, that we could
meeting, say, there'll be a section that might be reviewed.
Right. And so if Mark, if our staff identifies a section that has been updated, amended, or somehow improved, they could bring it to us and say, here is the information regarding policies and procedures about special valuation. Or is that the kind of thing we're talking about, Dan? Or the application process for placing your property on the historic register?
Sure. And to make sure I'm following you, Andy, what you're proposing is that at each monthly meeting of the commission, have a section of changes that's in draft form, just going over what the rules and procedures presently say and what our proposed changes, and providing some interpretation of the impact of those.
Yes, because in so doing, since we get together once a month, we would probably have a greater collective understanding of what's going on by the end of 2022 than we would if we hear a report on the part of people who have really labored over this.
Yeah, I'd be happy to support in that. And I think that would be, you know, something that we could provide in the committee updates portion of the meeting. Sounds good to me. Mark, is that something that you're up for as well?
Yes, I'm happy to help out with that endeavor.
And so maybe we could go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask a question, because I have like a full work schedule and just, you know, everyone's busy, totally understand that. But do you have like an estimate of how many hours of volunteering this would require?
Go ahead.
Oh, I think if you move it to the model Andy's proposing, where staff is essentially doing the redlining work and they're bringing it to the commission during a regular meeting, a section at a time, that should be far less demand on the commission than trying to set up a separate subcommittee who's going to review what are fairly lengthy codes.
Right, and I agree with Jen. I'd be reluctant to recommend that anybody undertake that, just because of the enormity of the burden. And in so doing, and I'm sincere about this, it provides us with a monthly look at that work and to appreciate what staff does. And then we all learn about it.
Paige, does that clarify your question?
Yeah, that helps. Okay. Thanks.
Cool.
So what I'd like to, the motion I would make is I would move that we engage in the historic preservation rules and procedures update project as a recurring agenda item in the time frame that Dan's proposed. Go ahead, Jen. Any comments?
Nope.
Question.
Sounds good.
Okay. Do we need a motion on that, folks? Do you think that that's just a request? And this leaves the door open. Go ahead, Paige.
I was just wondering if I get clarification. So this, instead of having a committee, this would end up being like a section of our meeting every month that we would go through together to review the red lines.
Yes, unless we have a really large agenda like we had in July, but it would, on a meeting like tonight, there would be time for us. And I think that would be a time permitting kind of thing that we could go through it, because I'm looking at the, I'm looking at the tasks and the schedule. And I think if we take a piece a month, it would get done in the time frame, even if we had to postpone it as an agenda item in a particular month, if the workload was especially heavy.
And Andy, I think we did this when I first started. I think that we had this included in our meeting initially. So, and it worked out very well, I thought. And in some cases, they would send things out ahead of time that we prepare notes or comments on, and then bring them to the meeting with us, so we could already be in advance, you know, prepared in advance.
That would
and
help.
So, just as everyone, go ahead.
Yeah. I just said that would help me. For sure, more of like a planner to look over things.
Because, for instance, we had two public hearings tonight, And I was very impressed with the degree to which people had studied those staff reports and recommendations. And if we had the ability to take a look at the rules and procedures in much the same way, it would be part of our prep, just like we read the minutes from the previous meeting. We would look at the policies and procedures. And it just seems to me that it would be way more beneficial for all colleagues. Jen, you're unmuted right now.
That's how, Julie's right. That's how we did the code revisions. We brought them back to the commission a section at a time. And that seemed to work well.
I think so.
If I may clarify, so that I'm on the same page. So it sounds, Andy, what I'm hearing in your motion is that this is a standing meeting agenda item. We'll take this section by section and bring red line changes to each meeting, and staff will share those as they're appropriate and with regard to, you know, whether it's city code or county code, that kind of thing. But with that,
and
we're proposing to not have a committee that would give kind of like red line feedback, or I guess blue line feedback to per se in response.
That's right. And as opposed to saying that it's new business or old business, it's going to be a recurring project or work in process that we visit every month, or we visit on months time permitting.
Okay.
Because one of my other proposals is that we have meetings of reasonable length, because I know folks' time is valuable and that these come at the end of a long day for many of my colleagues. And so I want to be respectful in that manner too, so that we can have a dedicated piece of time that's fairly reliable, rather than having some really short meetings and others that extend long into the night. So that's one of my other reasons for wanting to make this recurring time permitting.
That makes sense. Thanks for clarifying, Andy.
Sure. Okay, thank you, everyone. Dan, continuing on, reminder of training opportunities.
I guess the motion, Andy, your motion was made. Do you want to vote on the motion?
No, it dies for lack of a second. So I think that we'll try it this way. But and what this also does, Dan, is it leaves the door open to use a committee if this process I propose proves to be ineffective. So we're not okay. Saying no to a committee. We're just going to try it this way and see how it goes.
Okay.
It's the Franklin right. Roosevelt School of Policy, actually. It's not original.
All right.
Okay.
That works for me. And so I can move on to the training presentation. One more clarifying question before that is that we are going to give commissioners an opportunity to get in touch with staff regarding participation in other committees before the next meeting.
Yeah. Yes, please.
All right. Cool. Then I will go through some quick training opportunities that are coming up over the next few months for commission members. So on the screen, there are four upcoming training opportunities. The National Alliance of Preservation Commission Missions has a summer short course that is online coming up on the 24th and 25th of this month. The Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation, DAP, has CLG training on design review on August 27th. And in September, a four-day event over 5 days, the 2021 Revitalize Washington Roadshow, a preservation and Main Street conference hosted by the Washington Trust for Historic Preservation. This event features one online meeting and three days of in-person events at three different locations. And the National Preservation Conference, hosted by the National Trust for Historic Preservation, is coming up in November. So today, I just want to go through how much each of these participation in each of these events costs, give you an idea of that, and allow you all to decide if you want to support HBC members in attending as a whole or on an individual basis, et cetera. So on the screen right now, the unit costs are the prices for a single member to attend. So for the NAPC summer short course, it is $40 per attendee. It would be $120 if just our three new members attended and $280 for all seven commission members attending. The percentages on the side are the percentage of the present remaining budget for the commission for the year. CLG training by DAP is provided cost free, and the Revitalized Washington Roadshow, the cost for the online day. So as I said, there's 4 days involved in this event. Attendance for the one online day is $62, and I believe it's $109 off the top of my head to attend the on-site locations, which are in, I don't know if I got that one in there. Yes, Gig Harbor, Prosser, and Colville. So those are, there's additional costs associated with the on-site participation, and the National Preservation Conference, that is $120 per attendee. And of note with that one, with these events being online, they do offer the opportunity for commissioners to attend an event that in other circumstances may have not been accessible due to the travel costs involved. So it is something to consider with the price per member and participation. So as I said, the summer short course from the National Alliance of Preservation Commissioners, this is to participate in webinars geared towards historic preservation, commissions, boards, and staff. Presenters will present a variety of professional backgrounds, and it will be will feature opportunity for question and answer of the presenters. The Clark County Historic Preservation Commission is a member of the NAPC, so that is reflected in the cost for participation. The CLG training, as I said, is a free training seminar online covering design review, local register nominations, and special valuation. And the Revitalized Washington Roadshow, this is another event that is the Clark County Historic Preservation Commission is a member of the Washington Trust for Historic Preservation. So the cost for a virtual day online, virtual day only, and the on-site days, that is reflected in the cost of that. I was incorrect. It's $103 for the on-site days, not $109. So as I said, this is an annual statewide conference, and usually held as a 3-day in-person event. But this year it's going to be a hybrid event with 15 online educational networking opportunities on September 27th. And then from the 28th through the 1st, there will be 3 separate days, 1 day in Gig Harbor, 1 day in Prosser, and 1 day in Colville. Each of those is a separate on-site fee. So for example, if one commission member were to attend each 4 days of the event, it would be the $62.19 plus $302.99 fees for that attendance. The National Preservation Conference, it's an annual event and at the national level held by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Conference includes 32 educational sessions and networking events attended by advocates, architects, city planners, historic site directors, students, elected officials, commissioners, and Main Street directors. This is not an organization that the HBC is a member of, but the unit cost per attendee is $120. So this is just a quick snapshot of the commission's budget. As a reminder, the City of Vancouver funds a 2-year budget of $10,000 per year for 2021 and 2022. So any funds unspent in the 2021 budget year can be rolled into 2022. So at this time, you can see that 30% of the budget has been spent so far this year. The other categories for which expenditures haven't been spent so far are reflected. So we have a budget remaining of $6,955. So if I put the costs of those events on the screen, these percentages in the second column from the left, those reflect if the commission were to support today, say, making this an opportunity that all seven commissioners would attend, this is how much it would add to the cost of, or to the percentage of remaining budget. So with that, I guess I can pull back any details, but it's up for discussion, your decision on if you want to provide sponsorship for any commission members to attend these events.
Any feedback from commissioners?
I have a question, Dan. I don't know if you know, but I'm going to ask anyway. So for those three locations in Gig Harbor, I think you said Prosed and Colville, they're quite a distance from each other, right? So yes. I'm guessing that they're also discussing and going over various projects in those particular areas. So how realistic is it that we could actually attend all three given their distance? And is that something that the fees would be paid potentially for in this budget, but the cost of getting there and staying there would be on the commissioners, just to understand?
The costs that I've expressed here are just the cost for registration fees. Okay. I guess it would be up for you all to decide if you did want to sponsor somebody to attend all three of those in person. But yes, the like travel costs would be a factor involved in that. And yeah, I mean, travel between each of those three cities in 3 days would be quite a roadshow, as the title says.
It certainly would.
Yeah.
Julie, this is Dan. I just looked at their website, and it looks like each of the three in-person days has a similar program in the morning.
Oh, okay.
And then what's different is in the afternoon, there's tours. And so obviously it's a local tour.
Okay.
I don't think they're actually envisioning people attending all three of these days. I think they're envisioning people doing either the virtual one and then one of them.
Right.
Because it would be very hard to get from a 7 p.m. you know, wrap up of the one in Gig Harbor to Prosser for a nine, you know, an 8, 9 o'clock start the next morning.
Right. So. Okay. Sorry, I just wanted to clarify, just to make sure I understood.
I think they're trying to give people, you know, make this more opportunity. So if you know, I mean, obviously there's nothing in Southwest Washington, but it, you know, so the people on the west side might do Gig Harbor and central might do Prosser and east might do Colville.
I think it's excellent. I think it's done fabulous. Can you go back to the budget? I had another just clarifying just to make sure I understand. So if, okay, so if all seven HPC members were to participate in all three, let's just say, because you do have that column there, then can you show me, does that mean then that mean, so right now we have almost 7,000 in our budget, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so if everyone went to all three of these events, or four with the one being free, we would still have 5,400 left in the budget?
Correct.
Okay.
Would it make some sense, sorry, it's Jan, to just have all of us look at these conferences and then email either Dan or Jackie which ones we'd be interested in going to? And that way they could sort of compile, you know, how much this is going to cost and what might still be available, although it looks like we could pay for all seven of us to go to all of them and there'd still be money available.
I think that's a great idea personally, because then we can express our interests and then kind of be shepherded in the ways that are cost, you know, cost sensitive, I guess.
It looked like one of them was to take place during the month of August. Dan, was that correct?
Yes, there's actually two taking place, the short course, and I guess the CLG training from DAP is provided cost free. So
that's free, yeah.
Yeah.
If the CLG training they do have done, prior to COVID every year, usually in person. And for new commissioners, it's super helpful to just walk through all that. Do you have any idea what the time commitment is on that one, Dan? I
don't off the top
hours.
Of it's about 6 o'clock hours, I think.
Oh, really? Okay. That's a long day.
Yeah. But I think it is a whole day. I think the last one we were invited to was in Tacoma.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it was 4 hours in the morning and 2 in the afternoon. It was right wrapped up about 3 o'clock, if I recall. I think that was in 2017 or 18. It was really worthwhile. And if it's on the, if it's online,
so Dan, what would be the easiest for you? Do we need to provide answers today to help you with this budget, or?
I would. So I guess the request today would be if the commission is going to decide to sponsor members, I think that that's a budgetary decision that should be decided on as a commission. But I do think that I like the idea of you all taking some time to consider if this is something that fits into your schedule. And if you wanted to make a motion to reflect that, that you could.
Colleagues, since the only one for August that requires expense is the NAPC summer short course. And even if everybody went, it would only be an expenditure of $280. That's what we're looking at for this month. And then we would ask for folks who are interested in going to the Revitalized Washington Roadshow that you let Dan know so that we can approve the expenditure, because I think our September meeting is really early in the month. And that one's not particularly expensive either.
But do we need to still approve whether or not we want to just budget for 7 or 3?
Yes,
yes,
we would need to have a motion and a second that would approve up to X dollars for to cover the registration for colleagues to attend one and at this point it's only one.
Can we do it piecemeal like that, Dan, or did you want all of it decided? I guess I'm just.
Yeah, either it's up to you if you wanted to do it one by one or all together.
I will say that training of commissioners and staff is sort of the primary, one of the primary purposes behind the city providing this budget.
I would personally suggest just approving all of it. It doesn't wipe out our budget. There's still money remaining. And I think that all of these have value. And if the money doesn't end up being used, then it will roll into our overall budget, but at least we've set it aside and people can plan. It's just my thinking.
So Julie, are you going to make that a motion?
I guess I just wanted to see if other people are.
Because the probability is that even if you approve training costs to cover every commission member, the reality will be that only that everybody will go to one or two, and maybe somebody will go to them all, but probably the net cost will not be the amount we. So Dan, we could propose to pay up to sending all the members to all the opportunities.
Sure.
Julie, is that what you'd like to do?
Yes. So I would like to move that we approve a budget that will allow for up to all 7 commissioners to attend any one of these opportunities, these training opportunities.
Is there a second?
I second the motion, Mrs. Morgan.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded that the $5,400 up to, is that correct, Dan?
up to 1,555. I apologize. I could have made that clear in the screen. Subtracting 5,400 from the budget remaining, the difference between the two is 1,555. So that would
be so 1,000. So that it's been moved and seconded that we approve access to the proposed trainings for every commission member, and they'll let Dan know which ones they plan to attend. Is that the sum of our motion? Okay. Any further discussion?
Not discussion, but clarification. Dan, when did you need us to notify you of our individual choices? Is it time sensitive or?
That's a good question. I mean, I guess, you know what, I'll check and confirm if there's any deadline, but, you know, off the top of my head, I'm going to say as long as it's, you know, preceding these events taking place, then that should be fine. But I can email commissioners following this meeting if there are any deadlines, you know, such as needing to be registered a week ahead of time.
So, Dan, could you do, since it's a money item, I'd like to have a roll call vote, please.
Sure. All right. So starting the roll call, Julie Bond.
Aye.
Bailey Garcia.
Aye.
Dan Bader.
Aye.
Morgan Frazier.
Aye.
Hey, Joe Puth.
Aye.
And Andy Craig.
Aye.
All right. The motion.
Thank you, everyone. At this time, we're going to move on to new business, the pre-application conference for Parkerville Landing Site Parking Lot Concept, request for feedback on eligibility for certificate of appropriateness.
Kim Noah and David Rip, are you online? Let's give them a moment. They are in attendance, and I think they're just getting their camera situated.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you, Kim.
Hello, okay, Kim.
Great. Thank you. Hello. Sorry, we got a new video system, so I'm trying to figure out this microphone system, and our IT guy is gone for the day, so it's up to us to figure it out. But no, thank you so much for having us. I'm Kim Noah with the Port of Camas Washington. I'm the Chief Operating Officer, and our camera isn't really showing our Chief Executive Officer, David Rip. And then over to the side of me here is Mark Miller, our Director of Planning and Development. And we are here today to discuss and receive feedback from the Commission on whether our parking structure project located at the Parkersville landing site is eligible for a certificate of appropriateness. We believe this project will provide clearly delineated and increased parking for the historic park users, as well as makes improvements for other users of port waterfront facilities and activities. Can you go to the next slide, please? Thank you. So this highlighted area here in green is the actual Parkersville landing site. Next slide, please. And this highlighted blue area is the area of the site that we are going to be referencing and where we would like for a portion of the parking structure to be located. And this is obviously the requested area for the certificate of appropriateness that we'd be asking from the commission. Next slide, please. So this is just a picture of David Rip, our CEO, with three of the members of the Parkersville National Historic Site Advisory Committee that was formed in 1985. And they acted on behalf of the port as an advisory body. for the development of the historic area. And these are some great women that had a major love for this this area, and they really took on a big undertaking to finally accomplish this honorary designation for this park. And the site itself, just a little background, commemorates the Chinook speaking Native Americans of the area, and also the settlement established by homesteader David C. Parker, and later stewarded by 3 generations of the Van Fleet family. And the site was added to the National Register of Historic Places and then to the Washington State Heritage Register in 1976. Over the years, the port has enhanced or added recreational and educational elements such as pathways, benches, picnic tables, a rose arbor, 2 plazas, a kiosk, and a host of interpretive panels and 2 veteran memorials in an area near the marina. The Parker's Landing Historical Park is a popular location for outdoor weddings and reunions and under the flower-covered rose arbor. Next slide, please. So this picture is just an overall aerial photo of the waterfront itself. And if you go to the next slide, you will see circled, that is the historical park, the Marina Park, which is the furthest south. And then to the northwest is the historical park. And this is the area that right behind that historical park is the area that we will be discussing. If you click the slide one more time, it's just going to quickly show you this green box. This is currently where people park to utilize these parks. All the other surrounding gravel, grassy type area is where our boaters that launch into the to the Columbia River locate their trucks and trailers. Currently, parking available for this site, as you can see, is just not sufficient for the demand during the peak May through September season, because we have a conflict of a variety of users at the site, from our, like I said, our boat launch users. If you go on to the next slide, I can show you our recreational users of the various parks. We got the Parkersville Historical Park, the Marina Park, also our waterfront park and our children's natural play area, along with our mile-long connector trail that connects 19 miles of trail throughout Camas and Washougal. So it's a very popular site that people come to enjoy these parks. If you go to the next slide, you will see 2 of the parks that are further to the east, the waterfront park and then the children's natural play area. And then you can also see in the upper corner, the trail that users can utilize. The next slide shows you a closer up of what the boat launch looks like during this peak season with the trailers I mentioned in the boats. And those people are, of course, enjoying the boating out on the Columbia River. And then the next slide shows the popular events that happen down on the waterfront, from our 4th of July events to walk and run events and various other nonprofit events that occur down there. And this is in the Marina Park, which is part of that area that that's designated for this Parkersville site. If you can go on to the next slide, the port has what we've created is a flow parking area to try and eliminate some of this conflict so that people have another place to go and park. But as you can see, it's a little bit of ways from the Parkersville area, and they have to walk through this parking lot to access it. And what we hear quite often when we do any community outreach on surveys is the lack of parking. And these parks are utilized a lot for reunions, weddings, for the community. And a lot of the time, it's very difficult for them to be able to get the people that they want to come attend, where are they going to park? And they usually end up having to go over to this overflow parking area. And although we created this, at least we have something, it still doesn't meet the need. And then if you go on to the next slide, you will see that we also are undertaking a waterfront development. And that phase one of that, which isn't this whole piece, but more the front part of the waterfront itself, closest to the river, that's going to be completed in 2024. And so there will be, again, more competition for parking, but also that overflow area will start to be utilized with the development itself. Now, the developer has plans for parking, but we still don't find it sufficient enough for the users over on the west side. And so what we found in this most recent legislation that happened was this tax increment financing tool, where you can utilize new private development, the income tax, I mean the property tax that comes from that, you can utilize that assessed valuation increase to do some type of public benefit. And any type of public infrastructure is highly encouraged. So if you go on to the next slide, that is where we found a solution to our, what we call the P problem. And we just titled it the P problem because we constantly have this parking issue. And the green area up above is where that parking structure would be located. The area that would actually be on the Parkersville landing site is that red outlined area. And currently that area, if you go ahead and go on to the next slide, is a parking lot. It's a gravel parking lot for the boat trailer parking. So it's actually not even utilized by the park users. Like I showed you on that previous slide where they park over on the east side of the park. This is used for the boat trailer users. And so we would like to have the parking structure located up there. And the reason why up there and not down further, if you go on to the next slide, is there is a natural gas pipeline, two of them, that go through the parking lot. That red and blue lines are the two gas lines. And so you can't build anything on those. It can only be a parking lot. So that for any reason they need to dig to access the lines, it's available. So the parking structure would need to be to the west of that. And so that's where we'd like to create that parking structure in order to expand the ability for more people to come to the park, as well as to utilize other activities, the events that are occurring in the Marina Park. During those peak periods from May through September. The next several slides are highlighting the Secretary of the Interior Standards of Rehabilitation. And I just wanted to go through each one here quickly. The first one in response to the reasonable effort to provide a compatible use for the property. So as mentioned earlier, the current use of the property is to alter the gravel boat trailer parking area. So the original purpose will be to maintain, rather than a gravel parking lot for boat trailer use, it is to then just change that footprint to an actual parking structure, multi-story parking structure. The number two is to distinguish original qualities or character of the building, structure, site, and its environment shall not be destroyed. So there is no historic material or distinctive architectural features located on the property to be modified other than the land itself is a gravel parking lot. And the distinguishing original qualities of the site that will be altered is the flat gravel parking lot, and it'll be transformed into a multi-story parking structure. The intent of the property is to be a parking area that will remain, and the proposed project will increase the capacity and types of parking users. Number three, all buildings, structures, and sites shall be recognized as products of their own time, and alterations that have no historical basis and which seek to create an earlier appearance shall be recognized and respected. So there's no plan to create an alteration that seeks to create an earlier appearance. The property has no distinctive characteristics, but rather looks like other types of gravel parking lots. Four changes which may have taken place in the course of time are evidence of the history and development of a building structure, site, and its environment. These changes may have acquired significance in their own right, and the significance shall be recognized and respected. So there are no changes of significance on the property. Before the property was dedicated to the register, it was a gravel parking lot used for boat trailer parking, and there will still be adjoining property that will remain a gravel parking lot for those boat trailer parking users. Number five, the distinctive stylistic features or examples of skilled craftsmanship when characterizing a building structure or site shall be treated with sensitivity. And there's no distinctive stylistic features on the site. Deteriorated architectural features shall be repaired rather than replaced, and there are no deteriorated or missing architectural features on the site. Number seven, the surface cleaning of structures shall be undertaken with gentlest means. There are no structures on the site for us to be cleaning. Every reasonable effort shall be made to protect and preserve the archaeological resources affected by or adjacent to the project. And if there are any if an archaeological survey is deemed to be performed and resources are found, then of course the port will take every reasonable effort to protect and preserve the archaeological resources. And we're familiar with this with our other parks and trails and other construction projects in dealing with DAP. And number nine, contemporary design for alterations and additions to existing properties shall not be discouraged when such alterations and additions do not destroy significant historical, architectural, or cultural material. The design of the parking structure will be constructed in a way to complement the surrounding park and marina area with environmentally friendly elements. And in this next slide, you'll just see an example. It's obviously not the design of exactly what we're doing. We haven't got to that step yet, but we want to have sustainable elements that have the greenery to allow for that nice flow to where you're not just seeing a large concrete building or concrete structure. And then finally, number 10, wherever possible, new additions or alterations to structures shall be done in such a manner that if such additions or alterations were to be removed in the future, the essential form and integrity of the structure would be impaired. And so there are no structures on the site, so therefore there won't be any additions or alterations that would impair the integrity of any prior structure if the addition or alteration were to be removed. So that is a presentation of what we got from Dan, what we needed to bring forth to just get some feedback on whether this project would be eligible for a certificate of appropriateness. And then any questions you guys may have, we'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Kim. It's delightful to see you.
It's so wonderful to see you, Andy. It's so wonderful to see you. And say hi to Donna, please.
Say hi to Rob. commissioners, we may now offer the port any advice or feedback as to whether their project is likely to meet the criteria for a certificate of appropriateness or not, based on the Secretary of the Interior's criteria. As a reminder, this is not a formal decision on a certificate of appropriateness. It's informal feedback. So colleagues, please feel free to offer your views.
Kim, I have one question for the port.
Yes.
I was wondering if the port had taken into consideration in the design, even though you're not that far along, the adjacent Bonneville House and the view shed.
The Bonneville House?
Yes.
Is
Bonneville
that
House number five?
Is that to the west over by the
BPA? It's immediately adjacent to the National Register site, and it has also been determined eligible.
Okay. Oh, okay. That must be that two-story house. That's right.
Yeah, that's been remodeled and
So that's not our property.
No, I'm referring to the view shed of the parking structure.
Oh, I'm sorry, then. Can you please repeat your question? I guess I didn't understand.
Sure. Sorry about that, Kim. I was just wondering if the port had taken into consideration in their design the view shed for the adjacent property, which contains the Bonneville number 5 house, which has been determined eligible for the National Register of Historic Places by the Federal Highways Department?
No, we have not.
Thank you.
So a view shed is, and I'm sorry, I don't have the background and knowledge of that terminology. So is there a distance from the house that any other structure needs so you're not creating, blocking it, shading it? I'm not sure. What does that mean?
So usually when there's a project, and this is a house, so it's a structure, so it has a view. And if there's something that's going to be built, it's going to block the view. If the view is important, now I'm not that familiar with this particular property.
Right.
I was just, you know, looking at the house, and I think it's a great project what you guys have proposed, because parking is just a nightmare down there. But I was just hoping that the port was familiar with the adjacent property and the National Register status, and would take into consideration the view shed from that property in the design.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, thank you. It's been very interesting just getting into this project. We're finding out all kinds of things that we had no idea about. So absolutely, we would definitely make sure that we're sensitive to that.
Thank you, Kim. That was just something that I thought about. I thought that I might share that with you so that you could take that into consideration.
Yes, thank you.
Morgan, any other commentary from folks?
I have a question.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you. I was just wondering if the top part of the parking structure was going to be for parking and open to the air, so there'll be no covered roof on top. And then also, if there is a roof on top, what's the probability that you would be interested in a green roof to minimize warming effects of the roof?
Yes, that's a great question, because that's a lot of the discussion we have with the waterfront development is green roofs or solar panels, something environmentally friendly and sustainable. Most likely for cost, we probably would keep it open just so that there's just not another layer, right, of concrete. Would you guys agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that, just for cost.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Any other input from commissioner?
I have just a few small comments.
Go ahead, Julie.
Okay, hi, Kim.
Hi.
I was my only concern about where it is, and obviously your proposal explains why it is going to be where it is the archaeological potential of once digging begins, so that potential. And I know you already addressed that in your proposal, but I think that would be if you were to come forward with a formal request for a certificate of appropriateness, that if there could be a little bit more research done to maybe address how that would be mitigated if you do, you know, what kind of plans you have in place.
Right.
That would be the, you know, a lot of the history that you showed in your presentation does talk a lot about the Chinook people and their connection to the land prior to the homesteading. And so it does sound like there's a lot of potential for that. And so that would be the only kind of striking thing that would stand out to prevent something like this. I think that was the main concern that I had, which I know you've already addressed and you all are thinking about, but just wanted to reiterate that.
Okay, thank you.
It's Jan. So,
go ahead, Jan.
You know, working with DAP, they're going to require an inadvertent find plan. So essentially a plan for what you're going to do if you do find something on the site. So I think that'll get covered as part of the archaeology and as part of the working with DAP. I mean, this looks like a good project. I'm really the only concern is the archaeological piece, since mm-hmm. you're building a parking structure on top of a gravel lot. So, mm-hmm. and I do want to say, I really appreciate you guys coming for feedback before you submit your certificate of appropriateness request, because it's good to be able, and I don't know if you sat through all the rest of this when we were talking about the Stanger mm-hmm. House, but it's really good for the commission to be able to provide some input ahead of getting the certificate, because sometimes it provides a better application and also prevents us from saying no or delaying a project because we feel like there's more information that's needed.
Sure, absolutely. And a lot of that goes to Dan helping us guide us through this process. We really appreciate this is all new to us. So we appreciate Dan and all the work he's done with helping us through this. But yes, we definitely wanted to make sure we understood exactly what we needed from you guys before moving forward and filling out all this paperwork, like you're saying, and then finding out we weren't doing certain things correctly or weren't answering your guys' questions.
I do have one other kind of thought or comment, and it's also for the commissioners, other commissioners to comment on. You did go through the secretary standards in your presentation, but it gave me the impression that they don't really apply to this because there isn't a structure already in place. And those standards are really for the rehabilitation of existing historic structures. Mm-hmm. And so it just begs the question, I guess, if it's necessary for you to really address all of those. It struck me because a lot of them, you know, as you indicated, there isn't a structure here. It seemed to me more like the landscape and that piece to speak to that. And Morgan already mentioned, you know, the view from the other site, potential site on next door and so forth, but it's more of a landscape perspective and how that will be reshaped. So just when I was looking at it, I just had that question because a lot of those standards don't apply to this particular proposal. So if you do put a proposal forward, maybe,
Speak on behalf of the landscape more rather than just stating that there's
because you're not renovating or rehabilitating a structure. You're really proposing something on a site that's a landscape, right? The site itself is a landscape.
Yeah, I completely understand what you're saying. So I'm curious, trying to get a better understanding of the board and what you're looking for in when you do designate these type of sites. Because of the use of it now, I guess, because I'm looking at it from obviously a lens that you guys are not looking at it from. And so trying to understand on this landscape front, we look at it, it's like, oh, it's this gravel parking lot.
Right.
We didn't even realize that it was part of the Parkersville landing site. We thought it was the two parks. So when we found out it was also that parking lot, we're like, well, we need to stop on this parking structure. We had no idea that now we have to go through this process, right? But we have that mentality like it's a gravel parking lot. Would you guys be able to provide any feedback on what is it from your guys' lens of how you'd be looking at the landscape itself?
Well, I think you saw a lot of the material that you included was excellent. And I think that addressing the fact that it has been prior to designation or prior to the, you know, to being on the register, that it was a gravel parking lot. I think that was very helpful to know historically that's what it was used for and currently is used for and will continue in that vein. So I think a lot of that information, keep that information there. Okay. But I guess I was just curious how to apply the standards to this particular proposal, just because not all the standards are applicable because it's not a structure that we're discussing. And that's why I wanted to also throw it out maybe to the other commissioners who may have some additional thoughts or clarification on how to kind of address that piece, because we don't want you to have to go through the work of addressing things that aren't relevant to the site. If you're, sure. there's no building. So I don't know if anybody else, if you don't, that's okay. But I was trying to brainstorm and I was doing some searches, but I think earlier you had said, and Jen has mentioned, and I also mentioned earlier, that archaeology is really the bigger piece. And so, you know, and you addressed that in your proposal. So long as kind of those things are taken into account. And again, that history that you already provided is very helpful for us. So we know that, you know, it's continuing on in that vein.
Okay.
And Kim? I'd like to also suggest when it comes to the archaeological component, actually where you are planning to put the garage is not only in the in one site, it another site actually straddles it. So you're actually dealing with two sites up there within your green area. So I know that in the past you've worked with archaeologists who seem so knowledgeable about working with that, and I trust you completely in doing that. But you might also think about considering more of your treatment plan, because you are going to hit cultural materials when you dig out that gravel parking lot, and those archaeological materials may be related to the historic component of the occupation, but they also may be pre-contact, and then you might want to think about doing outreach to the tribes, to the Chinook, even though they're not right. recognized, and to the Cowlitz. And in doing that work in the pre-work, you'll save yourself so much hassle in the end.
So true. Yes. Yeah.
And they should take into consideration the view shed, which is kind of what my colleague was talking about the landscape. And I think you guys have a really good project, and you really could design it in a way to maximize parking, minimize the, you know, the view shed problem, and enhance the landscape. I think you guys have a good opportunity here.
Okay, thank you for your input.
May I say that Historic Preservation Commission is always very pleased to partner with other governmental agencies, especially when historic sites are involved, and we surely appreciate your presentation this evening, and thank you very much.
Thank you guys for your time. We really appreciate it.
And feel free to be on our agenda at any juncture in your project.
Okay, thank you so much. Can I ask one question? I guess I could ask Dan later, but what is our next step in this process? Obviously trying to answer these questions, but is it in more of a formalized process? Should I just be talking with Dan later to understand what that process is?
Yeah, Kim, I'm happy to have further conversation about how the process goes. But I guess in brief, as Andy noted, you could, as you go further in your design process, perhaps come back to the commission and seek further pre-application feedback.
Okay.
Or you could go all the way to the point of a certificate of appropriateness. It's kind of up to you from there. But like gotcha. I said, happy to be a reference as you work through.
Okay, super. Thank you.
And it's important for you to know we're interested in providing service and not putting up roadblocks.
And okay.
Thanks to Maureen for her comments along those lines.
Okay, super. Thank you so much.
Moving on, everyone, to a new item on the agenda that I wanted to place at the end of meetings, especially. When everybody has worked so hard and made such valuable contributions and demonstrated their thoughtfulness and dedication. Good of the order is an old fashioned way of saying thank you to folks who have helped carry out our work. And I wanted to make sure that Jenna and Dan know that I'm very grateful for their help, especially in supplying me with guidance for getting through the public hearings and to help our meetings to run smoothly. And many thanks to my fellow commissioners, because this is a volunteer situation. And in the wake of last month's meeting, I wanted to say that how pleased I was with the way we acquitted ourselves and the dignity with which we conducted ourselves in the face of opposition. And so with that, I wanted to include good of the order and have anybody who wanted to give a shout out to a particular member of staff or a fellow commissioner. This is the good time to do it.
I will say that I'm not sure whom I'm addressing, but whomever had the fantastic idea of adding the 90-day provision onto the end of the application to delay the demolition, and then getting the feedback from the community and getting that letter really It really was very important to me, and it really made me feel like our work was really valued and warranted. And I felt very appreciative too, that I believe it was a city member who put that forward.
Thanks for that, Morgan. Anybody else?
I actually just want to, I want to welcome the three commissioners. I wasn't here on last July's meeting. So I just want to welcome you all. And, you know, I did go through the notes and I actually did listen to the first hour of the 3-hour meeting. And so I will just say, you know, thanks for sticking with us and for showing up today and being present and for all the valuable contributions you've already provided to the commission. So welcome to our intimate group. And I look forward to seeing you all hopefully in the near future. I did want to ask if that is still moving forward. I know there was an email that came out recently saying that we may be returning in September. And I was curious if that is actually still happening or if that's delayed again.
That's a good question to raise, Julie. So at this time, County Council did delay. They were intending to start hybrid meetings as of August 3rd, and that got delayed 1 month. And at this time, the Department of Community Planning is seeking guidance from Council's office and trying to follow their lead in terms of the formatting and logistics of our hybrid meetings. So we're still working on that guidance with County Council as they've delayed that further. But one thing that is, of course, kind of playing a role in the decision too is the COVID-19 case numbers that have been increasing locally lately has been playing a role in some internal discussion of, at this time, Council's decision is that we are deferring for another month, but that could change depending upon how case numbers go. So I'll definitely be, you'll be hearing from Jackie or I, you know, as we have further updates. But at this time, fingers crossed, the hybrids meetings will be coming within probably about a month's time of following Council's lead.
Thank you. And thanks, Andy, for the opportunity to welcome everybody.
Well, my pleasure. And well, at this time, if there are no other comments, I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
I move to adjourn.
Is there a second?
I second.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded that our meeting be adjourned. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Nice to see you, everyone. Thank you for your attendance and your commentary and all your hard work.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andy.
Thank you, everybody.
Good night.
Bye.
Good night, Bailey. Good night, Morgan.